To item number 11, that's the Lower Columbia River Sturgeon Population Status and Management. This is annual review. It is a briefing and public input as well. So, Patrick, take it away.
He's not coming to my birthday party. He's not coming to my birthday party.
Not too sure. No.
You got that noted, right?
Wrong tie.
Okay.
No. No, him. Tim Hammond.
Oh, he's not coming. No.
No, these guys are.
They're staff.
Yeah.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Pat Frazier, and I'm the Region 5 Policy Coordinator for WDFW, and seated to my left is Brad James, and he's our sturgeon biologist and sturgeon management person for Region 5, who's extremely capable and a great employee for us for many years here. So today we're here to talk about the review of the annually we have to review the sturgeon policy and update you on stock status and other information according with the policy that you adopted several years ago. And there's a quick language of why we're here today. A little bit of background. I'll go through these first query quickly because most of us probably know all this already, but we're talking about the Lower Columbia white sturgeon population. We're not talking about the populations above Bonneville Dam. These fish are known to migrate to tributaries of the Columbia River, including and coastal areas in Washington, Oregon, Puget Sound, and even up into Canada and the Fraser River at times. The topics outlined for the potential review topics are all those listed there. Today we're really focusing on the two that are highlighted, the predation and the stock status. That's where we have significant and meaningful updates. The catch accounting and the bycatch and those kind of things are relatively similar to what they've been over the last 4 or 5 years since we have enacted the retention prohibition. So here's the policy guidance that was adopted in 2016. Actually, the policy itself was adopted in 2014, but here's the guidance you gave us in 2016. And that was to maintain the retention prohibition that had been in place since 2014. And you directed us to talk to ODFW regarding elimination of catch and release fisheries. We did have those negotiations. They did not result in any kind of agreement or concurrent action that we would propose to the two commissions. So we did not bring anything back to you on that. So first I want to talk about some of the things that impact this population, and then we'll look at the stock status. Oh, yes.
Yes, go ahead.
Before you move on, I was a little bit confused about your statement about manipulation. You said we're focusing on the Lower Columbia fish.
Yes.
And then you said these fish migrate to the upper.
Right.
So are you implying that the Lower Columbia stock is the source of all the other sturgeon in the system?
Oh, no. I'm sorry if I misspoke. When I said they migrate to other Lower Columbia River tributaries and the coastal areas. No, they don't. Yeah, there's not a lot of exchange once you get upstream of Bonneville Dam. There's some downward exchange, but very little upward exchange. Thank you. Sorry for that mistake there. So predation, sea lion predation has been a growing problem with this population for several years. The interesting part when you look at this graph, though, is the yellow line with the diamonds there shows the abundance of stellar sea lions. And this is just stellar sea lions, which are the ones that are known to predate most heavily on white sturgeon. You see a significant increase again in that stellar sea lion population. But look at the predation, the number of stellar sea lions, but look at the predation, it's extremely low, which is a very interesting statistic to look at. What we think is going on, and we have some anecdotal data to support this, is we think the sturgeon are actually moving out of that preferred spawning area below Bonneville Dam and beginning to use other areas. We have empirical data that tells us they're using the Willamette, and we also have anecdotal data that shows adult-sized fish showing up in the Lewis, the Cowlitz, and the Sandy Rivers at far larger abundance than has been seen in the past. In some cases, this is the first year we've ever observed adult fish in the Lewis, and that has been documented this year. So while they're not directly predating now on these fish, we do think they are beginning to have some impact on the production of the population and the productivity of the overall population, because now they're moving fish from the preferred highest quality spawning habitat and the lower spawning habitat in other areas. We do an annual population assessment, and when we think about evaluating the population itself, So when we think about evaluating the population itself, we look at several different kinds of things, and we look at several different indices. One of them is a population assessment. We had an historic approach. Historically, we tagged fish and recovered them in a sport fishery, and that was how we did the population estimates over the years. More recently, when the fishery went away and we turned to a catch-and-release fishery, we were no longer able to conduct that kind of survey and that kind of abundance estimate. So we moved to an abundance estimate that used a research set line fishery, and that's been in place since 2010. Some other things that we can look at to evaluate this population include catch per unit effort, historically from the sport fishery and more recently from the set line fishery, and the sub-yearling production, which we will talk about.
This looks at it.
Okay. So the first thing we want to talk about is the abundance of the spawner size fish, the spawning size component of the mark recapture estimate. So what we look at now is these are the adults and the spawners, and they're really a derivation out of the set line. It estimates the overall population abundance as compared to, and then we convert it into both legal size fish and oversized fish or adults. And this is a look at the spawner size fish abundance estimates. And you can see that the estimate increased significantly, a 79% increase from the 2013 through 2015 average to an estimate of nearly 6,000 fish for 2016. If you look at the three-year average, that converts to a three-year average of about 4,200 fish, which is slightly above the Oregon plan threshold for 3,900 fish, their conservation threshold. One of the important things to understand is that conservation threshold is not the ultimate target. The ultimate target for adult abundance is somewhere closer to the 8,000 or 9,000 range, where that threshold is a target you don't want to drop below. And it's a warning sign that this population is in significant trouble and we need to take some significant actions to protect it. This is the first year that we have been able to exceed that number. We also look at the sub-yearling production, and we started doing this several years ago in the Columbia, and we have added the Willamette recently in 2010, and when we look at that production, here's what that looks like for us. The graph on the top shows the Columbia, and you can see until about 2010, there was some very good production in the Columbia Basin, or relatively good production compared to what we see now, which is a much lower level of production. We did have a little bump in 2016, and then in the lower Willamette, we started that in 2010, so we don't really have an idea what was happening prior to 2010, but what you can see in the Willamette is a slow, steady increase in the amount of the index. And I want to be clear that this is an index. This isn't an absolute abundance estimate. This is actually the percent of sets that we collected fish in. That's how this is. So it's the percent of sets that have captured a fish as compared to an absolute abundance estimate. The other thing to notice is in the lower Columbia, we have nearly 100 sets per year, and it covers over 100 miles. In the Willamette, we have about 20 sets, and it covers about 26 miles. So there's a difference in geography and the amount of area and the overall production that each one of these indices represent. When we look at the legal size, abundance estimates here, which is what you see in front of you, again, you see that significant increase from 2015 to 2016. When you look at both juvenile and adult fish, which is the top, the increase is 45%. And when you look at the legal size component, the increase is 56%, from 144,000 to nearly 224,000. That's a very significant jump for a population that has just kind of been steadily increasing, which gives us a little cause for concern as, and maybe not concern, just pause maybe as a staff in terms of, and we know there's some error estimates around these abundance estimates. So let's take a look at that. Here's the historic trend of abundance of legal-sized fish. The squares are the historic method we used dating back to 1988. So we had a three-year transition period there from 2010 through 2012 where we did both the historic method and the new research set line method. As you can see, those estimates lined up pretty well, and they were pretty close. So we felt confident that the new research set line was a good way to estimate population abundance and use that in the future. And that's what we are now using, and that's our abundance estimate. You can see by the green diamonds that abundance estimate has steadily increased and steadily increased and steadily increased over time. Until 2016, where we have a significant jump in that abundance. And that looks a little out of place. You can also see by the blue dots, that's what we would have predicted for that year, for the upcoming year. So for 2016, we actually predicted closer to 150,000, but our estimate turned out to be 220-some thousand. And for 2017 now, based on that estimate, we're now predicting closer to 250,000. So the one thing I will have you notice too is the confidence intervals around those. They are relatively large confidence intervals. This is not a simple task to estimate fish that move around. And there's some assumptions that from time to time can be violated in our model that we're using. And that's something that we may have some concern over. Yes.
Note that the confidence interval of 2016 is much larger than the other confidence intervals. So is there any explanation for that? Less fish in the set line or?
Correct. Yeah, it's a smaller sample size.
And just to be clear, the confidence interval actually ranges from 118,000 to 330,000 for this year. So that's what that confidence interval is. And it could possibly be to a migration pattern that is different than past years where those fish actually left our recapture area as compared to stayed in the recapture area as they have in past years. Like I said, it's not an exact science, and these critters are challenging for us. So that made us look at some other lines of evidence or some other information that talked about where do we really think this population is going and what do we think is happening. And so we looked at the catch rates from that same set line fishery. And here you can see the legal size and the sublegal size catch rates. The one I want you to pay attention to is the green line with the legal size catch rates. And you can see there's a steady increase in that legal size catch rates. Now, if we would have expected that large increase in abundance, we would have thought we would have seen a large jump in that catch rate in 2016, and we really didn't see that. So that makes us wonder a little bit. We took this a little step further, and we said, well, how's catch rate correlate to the overall abundance estimate? And you can see for the years we've put in there, the green dots, we have a pretty good correlation between the annual catch rate out of the set line and the overall abundance forecast for that particular year, the abundance estimate. The yellow dot shows where we are now for 2000 and 16, and the orange dot at the top shows where the set line estimate is. So you can see that's the 223,000 as compared to the 150,000 through the CPUE. So there is, both of those fit within the confidence interval, so both of those are plausible estimates, and we're not saying one is necessarily right or another, but it's something that we should consider as we move forward with decisions on this population. So now let's go back to the spawner-sized fish, and let's take another look at what would that do to the abundance of the spawner-sized fish. Because the way you would estimate the spawners is you have the legal size estimate, and then based on the length frequency from the fish, we estimate a ratio of spawners to legal size, and that's how we estimate the spawner. So the spawner estimate is heavily driven by the legal size estimate. And when you do that using the CPUE estimate of spawners, now all of a sudden the adult population drops to about 4,000 as compared to the nearly 6,000 that we saw with the other estimate. That puts us at an average of 3,600, which is just below the threshold line. So it's something just to consider as we move forward and we think about this. The other thing we looked at that we thought was very important to look at was what's happening with the length frequencies. Typically, when you see large jumps in the population, you will see the length frequency represent that and indicate that, and you'll see that coming. And oftentimes in the past, we have predicted that. So if you look at 2013's length frequency at the top, you see a fairly large abundance in that sublegal size frame. So yes, the fish we are seeing now, the growth we've seen was expected. We saw it coming, and it has moved into that legal size, and we're seeing that. If you look at 2014 through 2016, you see a very similar pattern, and you don't see that. And that's beginning to reflect what we think is that reduced production that's been occurring since 2010 and the lack of recruitment into that lower size class. So we struggle a little bit with where did this significant increase in the adult adult population suddenly come from in this given year, because we don't see it in length frequency. Now, that being said, growth rates can vary quite dramatically for sturgeon, and sometimes they don't always behave as we would like them to. And a friend of mine a long time ago said, the fish are in charge, so we always have to remember that as we go through this. The other thing to notice is the pattern of distribution for 2016 is very similar to the pattern of distribution for 2014 and 15. They're just all the bars are higher, which leads us to think that there may be some differential migration pattern that led to a bit of bias in this year's estimate as compared to past years. And that's relative bias, because it is relative. It's not an absolute, as we've talked about. Regardless of which of those estimates you use, the question is, what's going to happen over the next 4 or 5 years with this population, and what do we forecast? And it doesn't matter which starting point you have. So we've chosen 3 starting points for you to look at and evaluate where this adult the legal size population is moving. The 2014 projection in blue. So we started with the projection we had for 2014 and said, what would we see happen by 2020? That's the blue line. The green, the red or orange line, we start with the projection we had in 2015 and say, how would the population react? And then the green is we start with the 2016 and say, how would the population react and what would it look like in 2020? So the thing to take away from this is all three of those lines look very similar. You don't see a sudden increase. You see a very flat population, a population that's on basically a level trend over the next 3 to 4 years. And that's really the take-home message from this particular graph. So I've gone over a lot of different things fairly quickly, so I want to come back and summarize them. We don't have any one thing that says, by golly, this is exactly what the population is, and this is exactly what we should do with this population. So what we have developed is a summary chart for folks to kind of do a check and balances of all the different metrics we can look at and indices that tell us what this population is doing. The first one is legal abundance. So from a legal abundance standpoint, regardless of which of the two estimates you see, there's a positive trend in the legal abundance. It's going up. It's just a matter of how high it went up and how large it went up and how quick that increase was. With the link frequency, there is a consistent downward trend that's been there for several years. We are down to 69% juveniles. I believe the Oregon plan would like to see us at 90% juveniles. So we're ways away from that, and that trend has been going down over the last several years, the percent of juveniles. When we projected the trend in legal abundance, with the model recruit, that's fairly flat. We showed those lines and we showed a flat trend there. When we looked at spawner abundance, we do get a little bit of a different picture there depending on which of those two estimates you use. If you use the mark recapture estimate, you get a significant increase in the adult, and we actually exceed the conservation threshold for the first time. If you look at the CPUE data, you get more of a flat trend, and you don't exceed, but you come close to the conservation threshold. And then for both sub-yearling production and sea lion abundance, we see downward trends. We don't see a significant increase in the young of the year catch, so we don't see that really significantly improving. Sea lion abundance remains high, and as I talked about, while they may not be predating on them at the same rate they have been in the past, we do believe they're impacting productivity by moving their distribution around the basin. So we've got a couple of small conclusions for you and a couple more slides, and then we'll be done here. At the end of the day, the status of adult, sublegal, and sub-yearling populations have not shown any substantial improvement this year from previous years. The legal size abundance has increased, but as we talked about, there's some uncertainty in how large that increase is. You know, is it a 10% increase or is it a 50% increase? And the near-term population appears to be relatively stagnant regardless of whether you adopt a fishery or not. We did meet with our sport advisory group on January 9th, Monday of this week, and we talked to them about this. In general, the majority of the sport folks said, look, we've got a very nice legal size abundance. It's continued to increase for several years. Why can't we go fishing? The abundance is larger than it was when we were fishing 20, 30 years ago and fishing with far higher quotas. And they've talked about a small exploitation rate in the range of 5 to 10%. There are a portion of the sports advisors who say, no, we don't want to go fishing. We want to keep the catch and release. Unfortunately, we don't have a report from the commercial advisory group. And because we had a meeting scheduled for January 11th, Wednesday, but we had a bit of inclement weather which curtailed that meeting altogether. So we canceled that meeting. We will be meeting with them in the next week or two. So we do have some proposed actions, and these are proposed actions that have been developed by the WDFW staff. And those proposed actions are in part the outcome of our recent discussions with ODFW and our discussions with the sport advisors. And there's a couple of things that kind of stood out to us as staff that we think we should probably work on more consistently or focus on over the next couple of years. First of all is, We want to look at some kind of long-term management strategy. We have the Oregon Plan, which provides us some guidance, but we want a management strategy that says, okay, let's make sure we keep a good, viable population out there that's not going to go away. And second of all, let's get some sustainable fishery opportunity. We think there should be some opportunity to harvest these fish in some way, but what's that look like? And we want a fishery that is predictable and stable, and it's going to be there for 3, 4, 5, 10 years down the road. We don't want a fishery that we can adopt 1 year, 2 years, and then it goes away. We don't want to move towards salmon management with sturgeon. This is a long-lived fish. We want to be careful, and we should be able to have some kind of predictable, stable fishing opportunity. The other piece with that fishing opportunity is it may actually provide us some data that we don't have that benefits us in terms of our abundance estimate. One of the things that's happened to us with the reduction of the fishery, and depending on the set line, we've reduced our recovery for tags from about a year, year and a half to 5 months. So that's impacting our ability and the confidence intervals around those estimates. So there may be some real benefit from a research situation for this fishery. Second of all, we want to work with ODFW and talk about our methodology in terms of the research, the estimate right now. How do we mark them? When do we recover them? Those kind of things. Some details about that. Is there a way we can reduce that confidence interval to something that gives us a little more accuracy in the estimate? And so finally, I'll wrap up with where we think we are. We do want to continue to jointly manage this population with ODFW, which we have done for several decades, and it's been a good collaborative working process. We want to maintain that. So WDFW presents similar information to their commission on February 10th. And then following that, in the last half of February, WDFW and ODFW will confer, and we will likely come back to you in March with another briefing of what came from the ODFW commission and what our conferences with ODFW tell us, and provide you a briefing of some sort, just an update on what our discussions and the outcome of those discussions. And with that, we'll open it to questions and discussions, and hopefully I hit a timeline for you.
Commissioner Carpenter?
Thank you. When you come back to us in March, Pat, do you expect that you will have suggestions, recommendations, or just some general thoughts?
I think it really depends on how those discussions unfold with ODFW and where they're at. I'm not going to predict that we will come back with a recommendation, but we may. It could be either of those. It just depends on how those discussions with ODFW come. Is that?
I just think it's incumbent that we try and provide a vision for our constituents going forward of whether there could be an opportunity or no opportunity. I just think we owe it to the public to have some perspective on that early in the season, if possible. Early in the year, I guess, to be more appropriate.
And we will make sure we raise that, and thank you. We'll make sure that's a key part of our discussions with ODFW then.
Good point. Other questions from the commission?
Thanks, Pat. Really excellent job defining the uncertainties. And I think we need to always keep in mind that our science is imperfect. And you did a good job also giving me some confidence that we're applying very great level of expertise to these issues. So, but one kind of obvious question is, which has come up, I think, every time we've talked about the projections that you've done, is that it appears that the fishery has no impact or very little impact. So can you explain how killing fish doesn't have an impact on abundance?
I'll leave that to Brad, my science expert on that. I can give a shot, but he'll do far better than me.
So we also have a chart that a couple of charts. One is just a repeat of what Pat showed as the trajectory of, say, the legal size population over the next 4 years. It's in attachment one on page 7. And it would be figure 8 in that.
Fine. Between. You can just go ahead and talk with
me. Sure. And so all that is again, taking a look at, based on the current size structure of the population and current abundance, how at least the legal size population would respond number-wise if it were harvested. It's modeled with a couple of different harvest scenarios, a 5% and a 10%. And what that does show is that actually affects abundance going forward. And both under either of the two harvest scenarios, we have at least some, if not some substantial level of decline.
Okay.
Other questions? Just one for either of you. The increase in sea lines, do you have an end for that? I mean, an overall number? I mean, I see it's going up. I'm just, what percent do you reckon in the last decade, or?
In terms of how high it's gone up, or how
just high raw number of how many sea lions are present?
It might actually say that on the graph.
Yeah, I looked back to see. Probably does. I missed it. But.
So, Chairman Smith, just in the Columbia itself, the combination of California sea lions and Stellar sea lions has increased. It's got to be in the low thousands, at least for California sea lions, and. Numbers of Stellar sea lions are quite a bit lower than the number of California sea lions, but I think just in general they have also continued to increase somewhat. Last 4 years or so we've had particularly large runs of Yukon smelt, so the sea lions that might be hanging out around the Astoria area now have something to follow upstream to feed on. And so our sense is, you know, whether, you know, I don't have access to an actual estimate of number of sea lions. It's just this general sense, talking among other biologists, that there has been an increase in the last few years.
And this is a difficult question. I know there's probably not an answer, but... And I understand the ramifications of the Marine Mammal Act and all that, but is there any action afoot to reduce that population? I mean, i.e., a cormorant scenario?
So there is a plan in place that's been in place for a few years where we have a trapping program up there, and fish are marked. I mean, sea lions are marked if they're predating on salmon or sturgeon, and then they're marked once when they're trapped. Then they're released, and if they come back into the trap again, then they are taken somewhere else, whether it be to an aquarium or some other location. In some cases, I think we've actually had some euthanization of some of those animals. But it's not as large scale as the cormorant plan was. And it's,
I didn't mean as large scale, just yeah. as a...
It's in a more limited scope, right. And... But that's what we do have, and that was worked out over several years of work and negotiations by Guy Norman when he worked with WDFW to get that in place, and that will continue in the future. But as you can see, its effectiveness is somewhat limited in terms of it. And these numbers here you see up here are just what they can observe from Bonneville Dam. So this is, but probably, you know, and so we don't have a full basin-wide estimate for these critters.
That's right. Okay. Thank you.
I think at the last presentation that you gave, you talked about the distribution of the white sturgeon from San Francisco Bay north up into the Columbia Basin and north of that into Puget Sound, and I believe that you said that they were also in the Fraser River. Is there any attempt out there to consolidate any kind of scientific information that you might have on standing stock, the assumption being that this is a single stock of fish that migrates between basins, water basins, and in the marine environment. Is there any attempt out there to determine what the overall standing stock is of a white sturgeon?
So both down in California, in the San Francisco Bay and the river systems that feed that area, and then up in the Fraser River, there are ongoing population assessments. And for instance, I have a better understanding of what's done up in the Fraser River. And that population isn't anywhere near the size of the lower Columbia population. They don't have a harvest fishery. and haven't had one for a number of years. The population itself has kind of stabilized at about 50,000 fish, and one of their challenges is, you know, why isn't it growing without harvest? I don't think they have a complete understanding yet at this point. It's not dammed, so there should be access to good spawning areas and whatnot.
How about marine mammals?
And you know, we've conveyed what's happened down here to the folks who work up there, and I haven't had any feedback that suggests that they have a marine mammal problem at this point. And as far as the population assessments down in the San Francisco area, that population seems to cycle up and down. Again, it might be influenced by successful, ranges and successful spawning conditions, by water year, that type of thing. Both in the Fraser, here in the Columbia, and down in the California population, the population assessments include tagging fish. We, on rare occasions, will get recovery of a fish that had been in one of those other systems when they were tagged. They show up here or vice versa. So there's some movement, but I think all three populations are, for the most part, localized.
Thank you.
Question made me think of another. We talk about predation threats. Is anything known about the impact that climate change and changes in water quality and temperature might have on these populations in the future?
So, for that question, I would think more about the entire Columbia River Basin. So, with all the dams we have, there's still remnant populations of white sturgeon on up to Canada and on over into Idaho. They're trapped within the impoundments. And the availability of good spawning habitat tends to be low or almost non-existent. And the reservoirs, we've learned here just in the recent past, 2 years ago in particular, water temperatures can get high enough that the large adult-sized fish seem most susceptible to stress, and so there have been die-off events.
Yeah, and I'm also aware that the Hell's Canyon population seems to be on a decline in the snake.
Yeah. Any last questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Very informative. And we do have public input on this. And again, I will call you up two at a time. Harry Barber and Greg Johnson, please. Good to see you, Harry.
Good morning. My name is Harry Barber. I'm with CCA, and also I'm on the board of the Lower Columbia Fish Enhancement Group and on the Recreational Advisory Group. I'd just like to make a few comments, primarily based on the slides that Pat showed this morning. With the legal abundance, you've got two estimates, the mark recapture and the CPU regression. The big estimate, 223,000, is not supported by the CPUE trends, and I wouldn't say it's a flyer, but I'm very skeptical of that estimate. Confidence interval around that estimate is plus or minus 50%. I mean, it's huge. I'm an old statistician, and that should be alarming to everybody in this room, that we don't have better estimates of what these populations are. If you look at the frequency length distribution. We're down to 65% juveniles. If you read the Oregon Conservation Plan that we have bought into and you have supported, ideal is 95% juveniles. Back in 2000, we had 92% juveniles in the population. If you think about that histogram that he showed, now we're down to 65%. This is a population that is severely stressed and I think is really, really sick. If you go to adult abundance, again, we've got two estimates, one above the conservation threshold, one that's been below it for 3 years. Conservation threshold in the Oregon plan, and I sat in on all five meetings where the plan was developed, that is a red flag. It's not the goal. The goal for adults is 9,120. And we've been below the conservation threshold for 3 years with a one method of estimate, and now we're above it with the other. But that was supposed to be a red flag. If you fell below the conservation threshold, it demanded immediate corrective action. And we have ceased harvest for 3 years, but of course the gillnets have continued, and they're catching over 1,000 oversized sturgeon every year. Sub-yearling production continues to be a major problem, seventh year in a row, very poor productivity. The sea lion abundance numbers are really interesting. Sea lion numbers are at an all-time high. Back 5 and 6 years ago, they were estimating between 2,000 and 3,000 sturgeon eaten by sea lions, primarily observing up at Bonneville Dam. Now they're estimating about 60. So the bad news is that I think the sturgeons just aren't there. They've been driven out. Gillnets haven't helped. I think the sea lions have driven them out. And there's some speculation, well, they're spawning in the loos or they're spawning in the collets. That's just ridiculous in my mind. Sturgeon need high turbulence water to spawn successfully. And there's no turbulence in those trips where some sturgeon have been observed. So we've got a situation where the spawners are not where they need to be to spawn. And I think the future is pretty dim. In terms of Path 70 to the strategy, I think we need some goals. What are the goals for yearling numbers? What are the goals for productivity? What are the goals for legal? And what are the goals for oversize? Thank you.
Thank you, Harry. Butch Smith, please. And Greg?
Good morning. Greg Johnson. So as was been stated, we didn't get our sturgeon briefing and due to the weather, so I pretty much reserve comment because we normally have about an hour of questioning and dialogue that occurs to expand upon the presentation. The only thing I would add is that in the upper area above the Longview Bridge, we're still not seeing very many sturgeon up there, and I think it's a product of the sea lion population has driven them out of the upper area, and the river condenses down, and they can have a greater effect on hurting those fish. And I can't speak to how many they've eaten; they obviously have. And then the second point, there's been a lot of discussion in terms about the handle of sturgeon and gillnet fisheries and represented through modeling or observations that occurred in 2010, 2012. I guess that's the problem with just short take a peek monitoring is that it's not an analysis, it's just raw data. And in one of those monitoring efforts, the department hasn't expanded that. Some of the public does, but so both, I'm going to jump over here a little bit. Both commissions have indicated that they intend to direct staff to have a monitoring program in the fall for the commercial fishery. So one thing that program would serve would be to clarify and confirm steelhead handle. And in the matrix that's in model that's used for that to identify that. Second thing it would do is be able to truly identify what's occurring in terms of the handle of sturgeon. So I think that would be a benefit of that. And so we can clarify some of the things that are being said, whether they're accurate or not. And lastly, I've been afforded significant opportunity with all of you on the salmon issue, so I'm likely not going to speak on it. And I'd like to, it's been a long process, at least 4 years on this, and I know you've all given significant of your time personally, and I'd just like to thank you now, and that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Yes.
We have to thank you, too, Greg. You've just been a terrific person to be interacting with, so thanks very much.
And I second that.
Okay.
I'll move on down. Your professionalism is appreciated.
All right. Thanks.
All four of it.
And Clancy Holt and cousin Butch. You're up.
I think Clancy just stepped out.
Oh, is Clancy? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, Commission. My name is Butch Smith. I'm from Elwaco, Washington. I represent the Elwaco Charter Association. I am also on the Sport Advisory Panel that Pat Frazier spoke of, and I'm a Port of Elwaco Commissioner, among other things. I only got 3 minutes. It'll take 10 minutes to do all the stuff that I'm on. First of all, we have a commissioner leaving. Connie, I don't think we've ever agreed once, but in saying that, you know, you have shown dedication to this commission and afforded a lot of time and a lot of effort, and I believe you champion your decisions whether we agree or not, and I for one appreciate anybody being one that's been on city councils and port commissions and everything else. It's not always a fun job, but you have been dedicated over the years, so I want to show my appreciation and thank you for serving, and wish you much health in your retirement.
Thank you, Butch. And I'll tell you what I've told others about, you know, retiring from the commission. It's the people here. It's people like you that are dedicated to the resource that are the important aspects of this commission to me. And thank you.
Thank you, sir. With the presentation, we do have some very good positive points in the sturgeon population, and I for one fished the estuary, and unfortunately what was once a really robust fisheries to my community, the Sturge Sport community down there in the estuary, I was the only charter boat in the month of May, June, and a little bit into July. Now, I'm not speaking of guide boats, I'm just speaking of the charter industry, and that's really sad. But the positive thing is you had to hide your hook to bait it. I mean, it was absolutely the most phenomenal fisheries I've seen down there in my 30-plus years of fishing sturgeon. Absolutely phenomenal. So I think the trends, whether we agree it's 320,000 or 180,000, I truly believe they're going in the right direction, and the same with the oversize. I am will be asking for a conservative harvest level this year. But I think it's real important, especially in lieu of all the stuff that's going on with the Kitsopper plan and all this, that we keep the Oregon Commission and the bi-state spirit alive. And I would concur with the recommendation of the state to let Oregon's commission get the same presentation you guys got, and let them, without bias, without you guys saying yay or nay, let them look at it. And come back in March, probably. I think it's probably the nearest time, and see what the two best minds in my mind, the Washington Fish and Wildlife and the Oregon Fish and Wildlife, especially on sturgeon, come back and recommend to you. I think that I said this last year. I thought we overjumped the decision in Oregon, and I don't want to do that anymore, because I guess I'm old enough now, when the two states didn't concur, where we had different regulations, we had to stay on one side of the river. And I don't want to go back to that. I want the two states to come together and the best minds move something forward, whether it's up or down. I think that's a better way to go. And anyway, I'll just close with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Butch, and thank you for your appropriately kind words for Connie. Marion Doolittle, please, and Clancy.
I pass.
Pardon?
I pass.
Okay, thank you, sir. Nathan Birch? Burke? Which is it?
Burke.
Burke, okay. Thank you. Okay, Clancy.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, and Director Unsworth, thank you for given us the opportunity to try to show you what's going on with this sturgeon population. And I'm just going to give you a hands-on view of what we've seen as we fished for the last 3 or 4 years. It's catch and release right now, but I think that your statistics, and I don't think you've had enough time. Sturgeon, it takes a sturgeon 20 years to reach maturity and spawn. And in these few years that you have here doesn't really reflect what's happening with the population, according to my experience on the water, all every day. And I think that the sturgeon population did hit a low 4 or 5 years ago, and it was a really major concern. But I'm not sure what caused it or where it came from. Of course, you've seen predation and all that. You get all that. But I'm not so sure that these fish just haven't changed their habits. And I disagree totally about the fact that all the sturgeon spawning habitat is in jeopardy because of the Stellar Sea Lions. They are, in fact, in the Columbia River below the dam and in jeopardy. But these sturgeon are versatile. I guided on the Klamath River 30 years ago for sturgeon. I'm not real proud of the fact, because I was fishing on spawner fish, not knowing what effect it would have on them. But these were spawner fish that came back year after year after year. I only guided them a few years till I got a little smarter and I quit. But the Klamath River didn't have a dam on it to produce heavy-duty fast water like below Bonneville, but these fish propagated anyway. And I think these fish have spread out in the Columbia, up into the Cowlitz, not too much in the Lewis, I don't think, the tributaries anyway, and I think they're still spawning. I see my catches. Okay. Well,
if you can finish your sentence, I just...
Yeah. I'm trying to take it there in one sentence.
So the buzzer went off.
So, maybe somebody else can carry on about the population of keeper sturgeon in the estuary, and there are far more juveniles in the Columbia River system now than there were 4 or 5 years ago. Thank you.
Thank you, Clancy. And I do know that some of us, at least, there's members of my club out there with gray facial hair. Sometimes this doesn't, the ears don't work as well as they used to. So if I go like this, I'm not being disrespectful. It's simply another means of communication that my wife does to me every day. So maybe we could turn that up a touch too. So, okay, sorry about that. So Ed Wickersham and Nathan.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak in front of you this morning. I've been fishing sturgeon for 30-some years on the Columbia River, and spend a lot of time every year out in my boat, anchored up and catching sturgeon. I do see a lot of what your biologists are saying. With the current size of fish that we have in the river, there's not a lot of small ones like there used to be. There's a lot of what we used to, what we call the keeper-sized fish, and it seems like there's a lot more small, oversized fish. And they're not quite big enough to be spawning yet, but they're just barely over the retention area when there was retention. I think it's important that, and what I'm asking you to do as a commission is to continue the course, continue to hold, and let these fish that are that size continue to grow up for a few more years, and so those more fish can get into the oversized protected fish, and so that we have a fishery for the future and not a fishery for the short term. Please continue to push for long-term fishery and not a short-term fishery. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Nathan. And Ed, up to you.
Yes, good morning. Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, Ed Wickersham, Ridgefield, Washington. Not represent, but I'm a member of Coastal Conservation of Washington, Clark Skamania Fly Fishers. I'm a longtime member of the Columbia River Salmon and Steelhead Recreational Angler Board. And I want to suggest very respectfully to you that you continue with no harvest on sturgeon. I was here last year, same place, same time. I'm going to repeat it again. I hear all of the stories. I respect all these people, and everybody sees a lot of different things. But the data says we're not getting little sturgeon. Brood stock is not in great shape. We would certainly expect, if we stopped harvest, to end up with a larger harvestable population. But these are old fish. You heard it from other people. We may very well need these fish, every one of them we can get, and it's too soon to be starting harvest on. And when you're seeing our best data say that we're not recruiting juvenile fish, that should be really troubling to everybody. And, you know, it's really hard to protect things. I heard somebody say, you know, about an old growth stand. You can protect it forever, but if you log it, it's gone forever. And that's the thing about these fish. The other thing is that I continue to be very troubled that we have a 365-day-a-year hook-and-release season on fish that we're trying to protect and increase the population of. And that is an enforcement nightmare. So anyway, maintain no harvest. Let's be patient. These are old fish. And we could dig a hole that'll really make it hard to get out of. So anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ed.
That brings the public input on this item to a close, and